Welcome to the seventh installment of Talent Summit Back to Basecamp podcast series. We've invited some of our most influential speakers and special guests back to Basecamp to share their thought leadership and insights as the working world transforms at pace as a result of the COVID crisis. This series will explore how HR leaders can affect a more robust recovery while enhancing the working lives of our people. I am Robert McGillifaudrig, founder of Talent Summit and CCO of Sigma Recruitment. And joining me in Basecamp this week is the team behind the teams who propelled New Zealand to become the highest performing small sports nation on the planet. I'll be joined by Dara Sheridan, the High Performance Coaching Manager, and Christian Penny, leader of the Coach Accelerator Program at High Performance Sports New Zealand. Today we'll explore New Zealand's indigenous human technology and how leveraging difference can accelerate performance. Welcome to the seventh installment of the Back to Basecamp Talent Summit series. Today we're exploring New Zealand's indigenous human technology and how to leverage difference to accelerate performance. According to Maori legend, the silver fern once lived in the sea and was asked to come and live in the forest in New Zealand to help guide the Maori people. As the legend goes, Maori hunters turned the fern upside down and the moonlight reflected and illuminated their path in the forest. It has since become a national symbol of heritage, people, and place. A symbol of soft power, more recently, embodied in many ways in the effective and compassionate leadership of Jacinda Ardern. And New Zealand have recently become corona virus free for 10 days or so, and one of very few nations on the planet to do so. The name of the national netball team in New Zealand is the Silver Ferns, and last year they became the world champions. And it's also the emblem of the All Blacks, the most successful sporting franchise in history. Today I'm joined by the team behind the teams who've propelled New Zealand to become the highest performing small sporting nation on the planet. And joining me in Basecamp today, we have Dara Sheridan, who's the High Performance Coaching Manager, and Christian Penny, leader of the Coach Accelerator Program at High Performance Sports New Zealand. Kia ora, gents.
Kia ora.
Robert.
Very badly said, I'm sure. Very badly said.
You did good.
Thanks a lot.
Did very well indeed. Yeah.
So Dara, I'm just looking at you. So for those who are tuning into the crowdcast session, you're wearing the wrong jersey. I see an Irish jersey behind you in a frame and you're wearing a New Zealand jersey. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, I'm wearing multiple jerseys. There's a green one always on the inside. But for now, I'm working for a country and a system and a group of athletes and coaches that I've come to really appreciate for what they stand for, what they've achieved, what they're aspiring to achieve, and made the decision 2 years ago to move to New Zealand to be part of something that's different, to be part of something that's challenging. And in doing so, obviously have changed the jerseys and that. So so far so good. Nearly 2 years in, you know, the stories on the inside. It's been really abundant and really enriching for me and my family. And delighted to share some of those insights today.
No, brilliant. So some people would say that those who change the jersey to the higher performing team are a little bit shallow. But look, I take it that it's your profession and it's a decision that you made.
Harsh but true.
Yeah, well, look, and you too, Christian. So you come from Irish extract, I believe.
Yeah, I'm a McCourt on my mother's side, and we come from where is it? Darrow, how do you say it? County
Down.
Down, County, yeah, Down. County Down. So I was going to be coming there earlier this year, and that trip fell through, but part of that was with Darrow to have a little investigation into that side of the family. I'm really looking forward to that at one point.
Well, we looked into it, Dara.
And did you?
Within our network, we did. We couldn't find them, but but we did look, right? And those we spoke to in County Down, they all said that anytime and whenever you are or make it to Ireland, that you are more than welcome to County Down. Yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah. It was beautiful. And they also asked, in the meantime, could you have a word with Banbridge Football Club, Ulster Rugby and County Down Football?
Yeah. Yeah, no
so
problems.
We'll set that up here. So, Dara, I'll come to you first. I'll come to you first, if I may. So, you mentioned your 2 years in New Zealand. What has struck you about the high-performance coaching culture of elite sport in New Zealand? And how has it impacted your thinking of high-performance coaching since?
I guess what's really struck me is the clarity of intention over here that they have regarding New Zealanders winning on the world stage. They're unashamed about that. And how they've built and set up a system around young men and women who want to go on that pursuit of excellence and win on the world stage has been, you know, a 20-year journey. So I guess what the world sees now in New Zealand as a high-performing sports system has been evolving literally since 2000, when I guess you look at the games in Sydney where, you know, they'd four medals, and this happened, relatively speaking, in their backyard with their against the Australians, and that really created a sense of we can do better. And around that period of time, the government initiated pretty significant review of how we look at sport, how sport is seen as a unique vehicle to inspire a nation, but more importantly, to send a clear message to the world regarding New Zealand and what the country stands for and what they can bring to competitive sport on a world stage. And literally since then, the government have been increasing investment into sport pretty much year on year. And the outcomes, I guess, that have emerged have correlated really well to the amount of money that's gone in. But in between those two critical insights is really understanding what it takes to win, ensuring that resources are really, I guess, aligned to where the potential actually really is. So you've got this sophisticated form of discrimination almost. It's an elitism around that. And it's I guess when you look at the community, we work with 530 athletes, myself and Christian work in a team of five people who work into a workforce of 90 coaches who support and enable those athletes. And then inside our organization, we've got 100 or so employees who cross a spectrum of 15 different forms of performance support around the athlete and the coach, from nutrition, psychology, physiology, to innovation. So you've got this highly enabled environment where people can realize their potential. So it's really, really focused and very, very well resourced. And I think that's what one of the differentiating factors is. And it goes right the way to the Minister of Sport, who's the Minister for Finance. They don't talk about winning on the world stage. They truly enable it with, you know, the amount of investment they put in and how that investment has worked skillfully around the potentialities inside the system.
And it nearly delivered the treble for New Zealand last year.
Yeah, so obviously with cricket, netball, and rugby, probably the one out of those three where the Silver Ferns, the netball team, are kind of coming behind at a significant pace, and to go and win it the way they did was absolutely stunning. Christian was part of the team that worked with the team that eventually led that team to that success, so he can speak more articulately to that. Obviously, from a rugby perspective, the team All Blacks were heading for a unique treble, I guess, that has never been matched in the history of rugby. And then our boys in cricket literally brought England right to the wire, and obviously that was desperately close in the end. And it just shows, I guess, the margins in elite sport are so small, but the failure is so public. And I think this is one of the really interesting aspects of our industry, in that your failures are absolutely public, and in some cases in front of millions and billions of people. And that's what makes, I guess, the victory and the success even more glorious, because that's how leveraged that and how high staked, I guess, the reality actually is. So last year, nearly done the treble.
Very good. So you mentioned that Christian worked with the Silver Ferns, the national netball team. But Christian, you don't come from a high performing sports background. So what is your background, and how did you leverage your expertise and experience to impact higher performing sport?
Yeah, so I come from professionally from a theatre background. I'm a theatre director by training, and then by profession. And from this, the industry here in New Zealand is very small, so much smaller than the UK. So I worked freelancing until we had our first baby, and then me and my wife, who's also an artist, we just couldn't make that work. So I went to the National Drama School and started teaching there, taught for 9 years on a master's in directing, and then wanted to lead that place, won the role of the CE there, and spent 9 years there leading that school. So, you know, steeped in the performing arts, made heaps of really different kinds of work that would sort of mark my career, particularly the kind of range of stuff. So I've worked from community projects, aid projects in the Pacific and little fishing villages doing storytelling, community stuff, right through to full-scale operas and the festivals and things like that, and then a whole lot of made and created shows. But it was at the school, at the drama school, where we started to get really focused on how could we take the resource, because it was considerable relative to the setting in the arts, how could we use that resource to drive a better high performance sort of outcome. So, you know, in a national drama school, you get talent, you can just use it. You don't really have to work that hard at growing people. But I was with a bunch of really smart teachers, administrators, and we all really wanted to apply ourselves to that question much more, in a much more demanding way, and really think how could we use the New Zealandness of the national school to raise performance. We used that book, Good to Great, Jim Collins's book, has a kind of spur at one point to really go, okay, so here we are in New Zealand, we're small, so we can't compete with an American drama school where they're auditioning 2,000 people for 6 sort of places. So, you know, their talent is always going to be guaranteed. The talent that's coming into a New Zealand national school is just at a much more kind of raw level. And you're not going to be able to pick stars all the way through. Nevertheless, we'd inherited the culture of a British drama school, because that's where the early teachers trained. So we had all of the kind of phony faux star culture that comes with that world, you know, and good skills and technique, of course, coming from that. But we weren't really fusing the collaborative nature that New Zealanders know from our indigenous setting and indigenous people here, the Māori, with the school, with the education. We were mirroring a European education. So a bunch of us set out trying to go, okay, what happens if we really tried to work on that problem? And luckily we had some staff who were steeped in Te Ao Māori. I didn't grow up in that way. I've had to learn it all myself, but I was lucky enough to be alongside some people who really knew it. And we had full autonomy in the setting. So we could start to develop a kind of, in a way, a complex conversation about leadership with the students and staff. So the particular way we attacked that was to bring that whole community together once on a Monday morning at 8:30 and once on a Friday morning at 8:30. So anywhere between 40 and 160 people in one room being led by the young people who were learning how to lead. Once we got that really working nicely, I started to sell that out into the community. So it was there that I met High Performance Sport, because they were looking for other HP environments that tackled the questions of culture and performance. Because it was easier to bring coaches in to look at the way we tackled it. They can see their own world clearer. Sometimes when you're looking at it in another sporting context, it's too close, it's too competitive. You're always comparing it exactly rather than seeing the essential frames. So for 9 years, I worked with the program that I now lead, and they would come into the school for a week and I would show them how we were working with the culture. They'd see it all live, so they'd be in with the students. And then I'd show them what directing an actor was like, how that was, you know, the way our problem was, how do you get someone to be vulnerable under massive pressure? Like, absolutely what the body doesn't want to do. But that's what these young people have to learn to do if they're going to earn money. Because you've got to learn to be open, free, and involving in front of a camera and a whole crew. And da, 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 da.
Very good. It sounds to me like you've moved it from a culture of exceptionalism, that star culture that you referenced, to something that's much more humble and that's based on humility. And Dara, you experienced this. So what was your experience of this? And where did you see it applying most effectively to the world of high performing sports?
Yeah, so I guess prior to coming to Ireland, I led the equivalent of the same program that Christian is leading here in New Zealand. And
it's less effective, my dad.
Yeah, like, so I guess one of the things around stepping outside of the box, it's important to realize what's inside your box. And one of the limitations we had in Ireland was we limited training capacity and capability and expertise. So we did a lot of collaboration with An Garda Síochána in the training college. We collaborated with the Irish Defence Forces and the Irish Ranger Wing, all about creating a more lively approach to how we test and develop the critical performance attributes around coaching, because we view coaching and coaches as performers and they're delivering a performance. So within the first 2 months of arriving in New Zealand, the first decision I had to make was who was going to be the new leader of this program. And that recruitment process was quite uplifting for me. And obviously the standout candidate is on the call here this evening. And really what stood out to me was the differentiation around his vision and sense of what the distinctive edge that New Zealand have that we're not fully leveraging yet in the form of all of those indigenous wisdoms and how we could really cohere that into a really interesting learning approach that could enhance culture, that could enhance a whole host of really, really interesting outcomes. So I made the bold decision to take a pretty eminent leader from the world of art into our setting to apply and to take what he's learned to lift what we know to be true in our setting. And literally, I guess, over a year into that, it's been, I guess, transformational, the things that have been shared and the impacts that were all ultimately, I guess, beginning to see. And I think that's one of the great things about performance and the ability to perform on demand. You know, the challenges and trials of all of that in all the various different performance stages we're in life, whether it's as a dad, whether it's at work, whether it's in arts, whether it's in sport, whether it's in business, we all have to perform in the face of a demand and deliver something and make something happen in a live setting. And for me, I guess Christian's background and the ethos around live theater and the liveness of that just really brings an edge back into our training. So, you know, we don't sit there and talk about it. We bring greater practicality to how we train for the live reality where coaches ultimately get tested.
Nice. And I'd like to dig into that shortly, guys. But before we do, again, just to bring it back to our world, the world of HR leadership, and I think there's a lot of questions and a lot of options for those who are at the helm of resource planning, resource management, and this really is the time for a lot of that cohort to consider their competitive advantage and to shift from kind of survival mode throughout this crisis into competing and into growing market share and into winning, to take a word from the sports world. And each week what we do is we get a view from the ground, guys, just to get the pulse of what's happening, to help frame our conversation and to ground it in many ways. And this week, I'm delighted to be joined by a good friend of Talent Summit and ours at Sigmar, Aisling Tilliard, who's CEO of Tandem. Tandem is one of the most exciting HR tech feedback performance software companies in our space. Aisling, welcome. How are you?
Great, thanks. Great to be here and to meet you all.
Good to see you. We were just talking there just about the high performance sport in New Zealand, Aisling, and Christian mentioned his background in coming from performance arts. And I read a piece, Christian, that you wrote very eloquently around your purpose in high performance sports New Zealand and about winning. And you mentioned that your core mission is to inspire a nation. And if we take that analogy to HR leaders and their mission to inspire their people, to inspire their customer, and to impact in society in which we exist. And you said this, you said, and not just by winning, but by winning the way we know how, winning our way, winning well, and to be well as we win. And I thought that captured many, probably the essence of the impact of HR in terms of driving competitive advantage in the short term while enhancing the working lives of our people in the long term, which is ultimately our enduring purpose here at Talent Summit. Aisling, what are you seeing amongst the HR leaders on the ground that you're working with? And what are the more progressive companies doing right now to enhance that competitive advantage for a stronger rebound?
Yeah, there's been a big shift, and I notice a big difference even in the conversations I have now. Can we call it the post-COVID era yet? Probably not, but you know, now...
We can in New Zealand.
We can.
Versus the pre-COVID era. Like, everybody was on this march to change how they manage performance and people in the workplace anyway. You know, they were moving to much more continuous, ongoing performance conversations and all that. But I think it's gone much further now. I think actually the core purpose of how we manage people has changed. And what it boils down to is this focus on a human-centric design. And I think what people are capturing is, you know, in the past, we managed people by almost getting them to compete. You know, we stack ranked them. It was survival of the fittest. It was, you know, let's rank and yank everyone. And then whoever wins kind of gets the best compensation outcome and a position on a talent matrix and are identified as a high potential. And we had all these processes that drove us to compete really with each other. Whereas now I think the rhetoric has moved on from what was probably a bit of a 1980s hangover, if the truth be told. And it's moved on to something I think a lot more inspiring. It's moved on to, let's compete with our own personal best. Let's look for the untapped potential and the uniqueness of every individual and grow and develop and accelerate that. And if we do that, then that will lift the performance of that individual. And if we do it en masse, on scale, then that will lift the performance of our wider organization. And I think this kind of new urgency to changing the purpose of performance management, which is probably your most overt symbol of culture, I think the reason it's changing is people captured this culture transformation in COVID. It was the culture transformation that nobody planned, you know, but probably in some respects was the best thing to happen, cultures, because people found that, you know, people did extraordinary things in a very agile way. They collaborated really well. A lot of those silos that moved up, you know, as barriers between us got broken down. And people, you know, there was great stories. Like, some of my clients were telling me, like, they had a plan to roll out Microsoft Teams over a 2-year period. And they did it in 2 days, you know, and it was like, yeah, like, why couldn't we always do it in 2 days?
Somebody else
was telling me they were trying to get their remote call centers home working for 5 years, and they did that in 5 days. So, like, people were able to do incredible things in really short space of time, and they worked really well together and focused, and they were agile. And there's this step back moment where HRDs are going, hang on, why weren't we always able to do that? And how do we sustain it for the future? And I think that's the essence of what people are trying to do now with performance, is to go, how can we make it more agile? How do we give a really easy toolkit for managers and make it more human-centric. But that doesn't mean throwing out every process. In fact, if you want to be really agile, you've got to run by many processes. But it does mean rethinking how we manage people, how we manage performance, and rethinking what we're trying to do when we manage them. You know, are we trying to, you know, make them all compete, or are we trying to really bring out the best in them and deliver this really high performance environment by tapping into everybody's uniqueness and capability and potential that maybe they don't even know they have? So I think it's really, really exciting, really inspiring. I've been in performance management for 25 years now, and this is the most inspiring time I've ever seen for it, because people really want to do something new and fresh, and it's great.
I think you've touched on it, and again, there's an article in The Economist that we spoke about a couple of weeks back, where they compared the impact of the CFO coming out of the financial crisis to the impact that the CPO can have coming out of this human crisis. And you mentioned structures, systems, signs around culture, and I think some of the risk perhaps is overcorrection. And we've obviously been forced into this kind of action orientation. And it's amazing what can happen in crisis mode. But again, we're not geared, and that's not sustainable. And again, like, there is a risk of overcorrection on the return. And it also needs to be much more considered, I think, to understand what have we gained and what do we need to reclaim, on the other hand, to not being physically present. And it's a big, big question. Dara, I see you nodding and smiling a lot as Aisling's speaking. Does that resonate with your world?
It does. I think, you know, when you talk about a human-centered approach, it essentially boils down to care. You know, nobody comes to work on their own. I think that was a quote you shared with me, Christian, recently, in that you bring your family, you bring your history, you bring your identity. You bring so many things that can enrich a workplace greater than any other inward investment around a human being. So, like, for me, a lot of the treasure is inside that individual. And if the setting is created for that to be opened up, for that to be shared, for that to be understood. And I think the big thing here that's emerging is empathy, the ability to truly understand that human resource that's in front of you, to display care, I guess, in getting to know that individual. So one of the things COVID did for me as a leader was really, I guess, genuinely ask my team on a more frequent basis, how are you? You know, one of my team had a COVID test right at the early of the journey, and that was pretty damn stressful on him and his family. And that was quite stressful. And I wouldn't have known that unless we got very well practiced as a team learning how to care for one another. And I think once you display that, the environment around the performer can become a whole lot more safer for them to really, really open up. And with that, like, these, I think, are the original seeds around creativity, innovation, where people can really, really unleash their potential. So I think what COVID has done really brilliantly, the volatility of that context, the life and death situation of that reality, has actually caused us to tune into one another and just to empathize and ask, how are you? And if there's one thing, if you want to get somebody to realize high performance on a sustainable basis, they've got to know you give a shit. Excuse my language, but that's really, really important. And I think that's what a world-class coach, the cornerstone of world-class coaching for me, is a coach who actually cares. I don't know, Christian, if you want to come in there as well around that one, mate.
I totally resonate with your words. How do I say your name? Aisling?
Aisling. Yeah.
Aisling. You know, like how it brought people's different strengths to the fore. And it also flattened hierarchies really fast. So, you know, there wasn't the possibility to manage people. It was too complicated. Too much was moving too fast, certainly in our setting. And suddenly that unleashed a whole lot of kind of potential in folk. And, you know, essentially we work inside a government setting in HPSNZ, and, you know, it's very hard in a government setting to generate real pressure. Like, we see it all the time in the sports that we work alongside, because the competitions generate it. But COVID did that for so many settings. Suddenly there was a pressure that wasn't the boss, that someone could blame for creating the pressure. So, you know, there's a work for us as like, how do we, like, when you say how do we do it again, like, how do we make smaller sprints, smaller kind of work practices where people have got more autonomy? All of those kind of questions we're asking ourselves too.
Yeah. You know, I think it's super interesting. The core relationship, I think, between a manager and employee has fundamentally shifted, you know, because we've all got kind of very vulnerable together, and that authenticity has shone through. And like, even you were talking about care, Dara, like, we have on Tandem, you can check in with your employees, you know, and we've noticed even, and there's actually worldwide trends around this, that one in every five check-ins, there's a mental health reference. And that's new. Do you know, like, we didn't feel like we could open up about how we're feeling and you know, the impact on our mental health and all that kind of stuff before in the workplace. If that happened previously, it was almost a problem issue to be dealt with, you know, whereas now it's a very natural conversation. And I think that's the key. If we kind of give our managers some very simple toolkit to help with resilience, agility, sustaining the good of what came from COVID. We don't want the ongoing pressure and accelerated, stress on us all. You know, no one wants to relive COVID. But if we could bottle the good out of it, I think there's something really winning there. And we were running this this live event in Tandem, and I think a lot of people will know Alison Hodgson, the HRD of Virgin Media, and she coined this phrase, and I love it, because she was like, trust was the real winner from COVID. And I think that's fundamentally what's changed, is that there's much more trust for people to get on with the job. We trust them to work from anywhere, anytime, at their own pace. We trust has just got so much greater, but we can't lose it now that we have it, you know, sustaining it.
And in many ways, actually, that's actually a building block on things that we've spoken about before. So Ashley spoke for us recently, guys, in Dublin, and again, we spoke about the power of positive intent, and the need for candor in feedback as being truly transformative around one's personal development. Are there any coaching practices, guys, do you think that we could borrow from your world? And in many ways, I see the HR kind of leaders being the coach of the coaches. So in many ways reflect the function that you guys have on sport in New Zealand. Are there any methods or practices we can borrow from your world to enhance, to build that trust that Aisling spoke about, so we can be candid and that we can be transformative in our feedback.
You want to come in, mate?
You go, Dee, you go.
Yeah, this is kind of
well rebounded, Christian.
Yeah, straight back at me. So what I've noticed, I guess, in any athlete coach relationship, when you need to achieve candor at a certain stage in the journey or a certain stage in the evolution of the relationship, I would be aware of a number of coaches that would have an agreed practice around that. And I can remember working with Billy Walsh, who was probably one of our most decorated coaches in Ireland, coached the boxing Irish boxers for the best part of a decade, and we worked on a way around ensuring there was a license around candor called a come to Jesus exchange, a C2J. And when I would actually be working with him and I'd be observing him in practice and things might be right, I would literally let him know, listen, I think we need to have a come to Jesus. And we would be very, very clear on that meant we were going to take this interaction up into the space of absolute brutal transparency and brutal challenge. And we literally did that about 3 months before the London 2012 games, where things were really, really slipping in terms of the environment and the culture. And that come to Jesus was pretty, pretty brutal. But what it actually did is it cleared the air. It created a whole new set of conditions for him to change and elevate his thinking in order to change his practice. And looking back on the success that the team had in London, one of the things he talks about as a key inflection point in the journey was that C2J. So him being able to empower me to run that type of an experience with him when it mattered, and him, I guess, being able to receive it in a way in terms of him being able to drive and enable his performance. Because one of the things he said to me looking back was, I guess this notion of there's always a difference between what you are doing and what you think you're doing. So we can enable others around us to give us that sense of what we're really doing. It's only going to pay dividend for people and their ability to be attuned to environment and I guess things that are happening around them. So a C2J one of my examples.
You mentioned attuned to the environment, which leads us on to context. So Christian, I'm going to come to you now just to talk about what New Zealand sport has learned from Indigenous practice and ritual. Aisling, we'll leave you go. Thank you so much for your contribution and for sharing your insights. Keep well.
Thank you, Aisling.
Yeah.
Thanks,
bye.
Aisling.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for sharing. Take care. Bye.
So, Christian, the theme of this conversation is understanding and leveraging difference to accelerate performance. So what rituals or what learnings from the Indigenous Maori world have you applied in high performance sports?
So let me tell you a story about an applied process. In the Maori world, there's big emphasis on encounter. So we don't meet without meeting, if you like. So the most important thing at the beginning is to see each other in our difference. And it's done by creating a space. So literally like one group sits here and one group sits here, and then there's a space between us and they're in chairs or lined up. But it's that separating out in order to have a good look at the difference before we join that's kind of critical. And in that space, you can speak into the difference, but also in speaking into the difference, you can also name the potentiality of joining. So those two kind of things, and they get practiced all the time in all sorts of different settings. Daryl was mentioning the work with the Silver Ferns. They had a particular kind of challenge in that just before the World Cup, they wanted to play a series against their own players in a way. So they had a kind of an A stream that was going to go to the World Cup and a B stream that hadn't quite made the cut, but had been in the wider squad. So when I was working with them, what I set up that encounter between the A team and the B team, if you like. And I coached the Silver Ferns, the A team, to see the B team and name their value to the A team. And we did it for about an hour. And I was getting them to name the mana, what is the strength of those women coming to them? What's the spirit that they see that they're coming with? And what's the opportunity that's here in this room? So this is not familiar territory for netball players to speak like this to each other, in front of each other, all in the room at the same time. But it was so rich because by the end of that, I turned to the B team and said, okay, so you guys can now respond. And up popped a couple of them who were Indigenous players who recognized the forms, who knew what was going on. And then they just completely kind of said to the Ferns, you know, we're here to drive you to perform better tomorrow night on that court. We really like being seen by you, but what we really want is for you to go to Liverpool and win that competition. But in the meantime, we're just going to kick your ass on that court tomorrow night, girls.
And Christian, what did that unlock for the performance for the World Cup?
Yeah, so it frees the competitive dynamic. So you need competition. Like we need it. It's part of who we are and why we work the way we work and why we can achieve what we can achieve. But if it's wrongly wired, it's just static on the line. And if you're in an HP setting, it has to be really tightly wired and free so that everything can flow. So it just sort of took away any kind of niggles or questions so that the players could go out there and compete for the better of the game, not for their own individual wins.
Is it the space to express themselves?
Not quite, mate. Not quite. No? So not themselves, the setting, the role they have in the setting. So, you know, that's the bit that's different. So you're always thinking of it in terms of the context in which we work and why we work.
So it leads quite deeply into purpose and into the collective realization of purpose.
Yeah, and when the whole room, to go back to the night with the ferns, when they feel that, it's deeply moving, because that's why everyone's there, really. And to have it said in our own words to ourselves, about ourselves, it just liberates. It's very liberating and empowering and uplifting, because we all go, okay, let's go do this thing now that we're going to do. But we got there by not racing to it and not assuming we could have it. You know how that assumption happens all the time? We'll just, you and me, we'll get together, we'll work, and then boom, we fall apart. So it's a thrash early frame, essentially.
And Dara, you experienced this firsthand. How did it impact your leadership or how you view coaching and performance?
Yeah, so very early in my experience here in New Zealand, I had three different engagements which struck me deep in the heart, not in the head per se, but it started in the heart. And many of the ceremonies that I went to, I didn't understand, but I could understand the visuals of what was happening. And, you know, Christian makes a really good point around the setting or the context that creates the interactivity between the people, and the sequence creates the engagement, which ultimately then leads to the shared response. And for me, I guess as a leader, like, my natural style is just to drive a setting and, you know, and then look around and hope everyone is still on the bus, or everyone, you know, it's like a horse and a cart at speed, and hopefully everyone's still on the cart going at speed. Whereas my practice and my ethos has changed more so towards liberating the setting and understanding the differences and powering up that collective potential and then releasing it. And the three different engagements are, when I joined HBCNZ on the second week, so this was October 2018, I just left Ireland, like, packed up everything, left my wife and kids at home for 3 months, and I was supposed to come down and get the house sorted.
Deadly.
I was deeply vulnerable. I had a few nights out. My golf game got into great shape, courtesy of Ken Lynch.
There's other people listening.
Yeah, I won't go there. So October 2018, the HBCNZ had what was called a porphyry, which kind of broken down into two different concepts. So po means dark, night, or the unknown. And the woody means to weave or to integrate. So to integrate the unknown. So walked into this room with all of the new people in the organization, like walking into this space that was already created. On one side of the room was the entire organization, SLT sitting at the front. On the other side of the room, opposite that, was a group of chairs for all the newbies. And in the middle was a space. And we had a leader representing us, bringing us into this new world, and clearly kind of describing to us what we're involved in. And then there was a calling into the setting. Then the leader who was representing us spoke across into those that were already in the world of high performance sport in New Zealand, and then they spoke back. And over a period of time, the sequence moves on, and you eventually get integration, where we pass over from our side into their side. And that's actually shared. One of the stages in the process is called hungi, where we share breath, we join foreheads, and we literally breathe each other's breath. It's a really, really intimate, but I guess when you look at the concept of integration and oneness, you won't get a more intimate human contact. And I did that with senior leadership team in the organization. And I walked out of that room going, what the heck? I actually cried. I just left the job that I dearly loved for 10 years in Ireland, had pulled up a big deep root out of Ireland, was coming to this new country, which I hadn't really figured out a whole host of things. And in that moment, I felt incredibly secure and part of something. And to be able to do that in a period of 16 minutes is absolutely incredible. So that was the first experience. And then kind of moving on, when we recruited Christian, I had to fly down to Wellington to participate in a ceremony called a Potawaki, which is the opposite to a porphyry, which means he was leaving Teufelkari, the drama school. And again, on his side, he had his family and his friends, and on the other side was the entire organization in Teufelkari. And I had to attend that event and speak into him actually, I guess, being removed, him actively actually leaving the workplace, but in a way that was really skillful and authentic, where he got a chance to speak to the learnings and the challenges, and they got a chance to speak back to him. But then I had to speak on behalf of High Performance Sport New Zealand and make a statement of intent regarding what I was going to do to uphold his manner in coming into our world. And I was at this event with the Irish ambassador to New Zealand, who was just newly appointed. And I rang him up and I said, listen, come on, we go to this for the crack. I think it's going to really, really inspire you. And there we were. The thing went on for 3 hours and it was absolutely incredible. This live event over and back. You'd students standing up and telling this academic leader, this cultural leader, the impact that you had on me and that enduring impact. So he walked out of that setting, I would imagine, mate, truly freed to move on and to pass forward into our world. And I just thought it was incredibly sophisticated, incredibly authentic. And it was a real honor and a privilege to be in there. And I spoke a few words, Askelgat, and then I talked about my indigenous heritage and where I'm from in Ireland. And it was really cool to kind of represent that. So two examples of that. And then the last example was we've managed to codify all of these practices into an engagement framework that we now teach our coaches, and we bring them to Marae, which is an ancient community settlement ground where Maori typically live. And inside that, there's a whare and a house. We slept in that house for 4 days and we learned this practice. And we've done this like three different test events with our coaches. So we're now moving on to create a unique andragogy where we will teach the coaches how to create communities and cultures with these practices, which I believe moving forward is New Zealand's ultimate competitive advantage. Can we bring this 2,000-year-old indigenous wisdom to life in a contemporary society where, man, we have a lot to learn about how do we reconcile differences and how do we leverage diversity truly? And I think this is what makes this an enduring global agenda. It's bigger than just New Zealand, but I think New Zealand can be distinctly world leading in this, would be my sense.
And I think it's important to note there, Robert, that when Dara says, you know, the diversity, it's not the diversity of using the process. It's that the process focuses on diversity. So that separation is about getting clearer about the difference between Dara arriving in the place he's arriving to so that he can be more himself in the work.
Okay, can I bring it on? So in understanding, appreciating difference and the clarity that that must bring to people in a role with a job with a specific outcome. And I'm mindful of the world our HR leaders are going through right now, that there's momentum around change. There's an opportunity to transform. And what we need in our workforce in 6 months' time, 9 months' time, is very different to what we had before this crisis. So what insights can we learn into getting the right people into the right job at the right time?
Yeah, so I think for me, you know, one of the analogies that's really benefited me is a metaphor I actually learned while I was down in Gisborne inside the Ferdy, the house. And I guess one of the things that I learned inside that beautiful wooden built house was there was an architecture inside the house and a meaning behind it, like the three pillars that hold up the house. The back wall represents purpose and intention. The middle pillar represents wellness, which is really around what are the things that sustain you as a human being. And the last pillar before you go out the door into the outer world represents your point of practice or your point of application. In other words, how do you bring purpose, intention, and wellness to life? And one of the things I learned and the challenge that my team presented to me was, how can we build a house like that to withstand a storm? So that when you go outside that house into the world where things manifest, actions happen, failures happen, do you have a shelter to go back into where you can track and trace what you really, really stand for. You know, that core essence around sustaining human beings in the world that we live in, around wellness. And when you look at well-being and wellness as being a cornerstone of sustaining performance, we're asking people to do more, but we really ask them, you know, about enhancing their capacity to meet those demands. So that piece regarding capacity around how people manage energy, how they recover, how they sleep, and how they regenerate that, I think is particularly important. But this is all in a context of getting clear on why do we exist and what is the intention. And when I was lying in that house, it became really apparent to me that my intention and my purpose for my journey in New Zealand was overly focused on work, work, work. And I wasn't really factoring in my family or my whānau and what they wanted to experience in New Zealand. And as a result, my wellness pillar was quite narrow and thin. And I wasn't really feeding or enabling myself to be abundant, to regenerate myself. And I walked out of that house, having gone through that guided reflection. And there I was sleeping inside that house with all of this ancient metaphorical guided reflection, which was absolutely incredible. So I think it's really, really important that an organization has a very clear ethos around sustainability, a very clear ethos around the mission and the vision, and then enabling people to bring their unique diversity and capability to that. And I think the role of the leader is to really liberate all of that potentiality, to coordinate that, to mix that, to enable choreography around that, and to ask more questions and not feel like they need to be the person with the answer. Because that's certainly the big thing that's enabled me. And we've recently developed like an acronym within our team around how we want to be with one another. And it's called OUCH. And it represents four things: openness, understanding, care, and honesty. And there are universal values that can guide and inform how we need to be with one another. So right now, that's absolutely smashed the hierarchy, which is really, really good, because we've got new forms of leadership happening within the team, and we're interacting with each other. We're more bold, we're more confident, and we're more upstanding around the challenges as well. So that's my sense as to what I've benefited from seeing this man in action, Christian, and learning the ways of his people.
Well,
I'd add to that, Robert, that you know, it's so hard to know what it's going to be, right, in this midterm, long-term future. So going back to Aisling's points, like getting people who are aligned with those, with the organization and those purposes at the beginning is critical. And we've got a very successful New Zealand coach developer now working in the States in baseball there, and he's turning them around from just recruiting talent to recruiting people who've got the character that they can then make into talented teams. And maybe that was the big shift that happened in the All Black culture. You know, you were talking about that as a winning culture, was when they lost in 97, they really took a good hard look at themselves and then made a big shift there from, you know, just winning, just being strong, just being tough, to better men make better All Blacks. And so it's really starting to begin the work of developing their culture based on values and based on behaviors.
It's funny, it's you mentioned purpose, Christian, and people see this as a big capital P, something that's lofty and it's enduring, and quite often it's something you aspire to achieve. But connecting that with your daily purpose, and what's expected of somebody, so what's the input to deliver that output ultimately over time? And to bring it back to the analogy that you used, Dara, around the house, you so eloquently describe. We had one of Simon Sinek's team on, speaking about why, when it came to purpose, and he mentioned that the why is the foundation of the house, and that's ever enduring and it doesn't change. But if you look at building from that foundation up, and if you imagine each person in the organization or the team as being the building blocks, the human capital in the organization, that's one thing to focus on. So it's that mastery of skill, job, clarity, expected outcome, and deliverables at a point in time. But what I'd like to explore, Christian, I'll come to you if I may, is the glue, the adhesive, the cement that sticks the individuals together. And I'd love to know, like, how do we unleash the potential of what's between us, the invisible potential around the kind of social capital?
Yeah, social is the key word, I think. Like, there's quite a need to upskill our ability to meet and think and share and leverage bigger group settings. So I think that's a real big kind of growth area for us now. Like, we're good one-to-one, you know, that's a common ground and a safe place, and, you know, reviews happen in that. But if you really want to glue a setting together, it has to happen publicly, and it has to be shared, and it has to be understood together, and then it has to be celebrated together. So part of why we're teaching the coaches that framework, those sequences of building that community, is so that they can start to get more conscious about how they structure that with their teams, with their, and hopefully this will start to, we'll start to roll this into the organizational settings too eventually, so that the organizational settings become more socially oriented and purpose driven. So, you know, even for us, and not even for us, that's awful language, but for us in HPSNZ, you know, we sometimes act as if we're just here to serve. It dries up really fast because it's not rich enough. It's not deep enough. You know, we're not talking enough about who we are as we serve and what it is we bring. So we've been trying to, over this COVID period, to orient more that way. And then today we had some people leading some bits of pieces around, you know, who they were and why they work and why they've come to be with us in New Zealand. And it was very rich, very human centric, as Aisling said. And, you know, that fires people up, that shit, you know, like that's what we're social beings at our core. But social skills around meeting, we're low, and that's where Māori have real big knowing and practices and practice. So, you know, I've been in those settings. You can be at a funeral where it's, death is being handled with such grace, care, meaning, and wit. You know, so I think we share this with you guys in Ireland. You know, it's just like, it's lively, it's fun, and it's serious, and then people weep, and then we go and eat and drink, and, you know, it's like, how do we bring more of that into the work setting? It doesn't have to be all kind of serious working, God forbid. The purpose should be deeply serious, but not the day-to-day.
It's not a dress rehearsal, it should be enjoyable. Dara.
Yeah, and in New Zealand, we've inherited a lot of the English politeness, you know, and it's such a drag on us, man. Like, that's why it's nice having my Irish brother here, you know, like, and like, it's like, and we've got another one too, and they're a bit ruder. You guys are a bit ruder. You're a bit more straight up, you know, but in New Zealand, we really have that English reserve, you know. Oh, we won't speak about you to your face, Robert, you know.
Yeah, Christian, you've kind of lost it. Dara.
Yeah, for me, I think part of the challenge with ambiguity and how we react to grayness, if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. And I think part of the challenge is to make, that invisible visible. You know, someone would said to me, if you were to do a TED talk, what would you do it on? And I said, the invisible bank, which is all about the potentialities that exist between people in terms of what you give and what can be given back. There's an amazing reciprocity that exists between how people can connect with one another and how it actually enables a collective effort and a collective economy. So going back to that point regarding creating the setting for that to happen, even when you walk into a pōwhiri, you can see straight away how the two sides are orientated opposite one another. We can see one another. And we had this delegation over from Malaysia recently, and Christian facilitated a pōwhiri for them. And they were absolutely stunned by, 25 of us on middle management and senior leadership sitting opposite their entire SLT, and Christian actually weaving them into us and getting clear on why are you actually here in New Zealand? And they were, you know, okay. So that was a bit of a matataki, which is kind of a bit of a provocation in that, you know, we want something back. If we're going to give you some of our intelligence, we want something back. And it was a brilliant way to orientate them before we actually begin to chat and discuss and exchange. And it led on to like a really, really good engagement thereafter. So for me, I guess, think more about the setting within which you want people to interact, and then think about the interactions you want people to have, and then let the people go and do what people do. They will discover, they will interact. And so that point, like not overly structuring it, is really important. And I'd come from that school of, oh, for a meeting, you know, everything bolted down, big agenda, overly detailed, and it's
too many slides.
Yeah, my team hammering me on that one. But that's good. And that's me learning too, I guess. Hey.
Very good. Very good. Hey, guys, can I just bring it on just for the final piece? I'd like to talk about the All Blacks. When we think about like the most elite performing brand in the world on the world stage, we think of them. We beat them twice, Christian, in recent years. But
yeah, you're really coming up.
Yeah, thanks a million. little pat on the head. But what I would like to explore is from a talent pool perspective. So if I look at the talent supply chain and how it's evolving, we either build it, so we develop our own, we buy it, we borrow it, or we bought it. In New Zealand, you can't borrow, you can't boss, and you can't buy the talents. You have to build it. So I'd like to explore that for one moment. The most successful sporting franchise in the world. So three World Cups, I believe, three quarters or so of the games played over 125 years. So in New Zealand, there's about 150 or so grassroots level rugby players registered with New Zealand Rugby. And the equivalent, say, to some other nations, there's 250,000 in Australia, there's over 400,000 in England, and over 500,000 in France. So, Christian, as a small island nation, how has New Zealand nurtured generations of elite players and dominated sport for so long? And what can we learn from that around building talent for enduring performance?
Yeah, I speak a little cautiously here, eh? Like, remember, I'm a man from the theatre. Like, I'm not an expert on how the All Blacks develop their culture. But like everyone else in the country, I'm a mad fan, you know. So, I mean, part of it's the web, you know, the tightness of the web. So we don't play a huge number of sports. It's not Australia, where you've got six competing codes. It's being dominated by that code. And then there's a massive infrastructure that sits around that. And then it's been such a pure expression of masculinity and now femininity too in New Zealand. So it's deeply woven into the culture. And so people know what it means and then aspire to it in like manner. And then the real challenge has been professionalizing that. So prior to professionalization, it made sense because it resonated with all of the social and community values of New Zealand. You were part of a team, you were doing service, you were giving of your body, you were a warrior. You know, those were all the things a man should do. Once we turned professional, the game kind of went weird for a while on us, and we couldn't work out why we weren't winning all the time when it was professional. And that's the challenge that you guys live in all the time, eh? Like once people get paid, you have to then do kind of more careful, more nuanced work to blend in meaning and culture so that the performance outcomes you want emerge. And that work really started hard after 97, after that loss, like I described before.
And Dara, you look from the outside in, what have you observed about the All Blacks that has kind of created the sustaining enduring performance?
I think, you know, there's clearly a relentless approach towards learning, which drives and informs how they continuously improve, how they continuously evolve, you know, from the outside, not even looking in, but from the outside reading about it. And, you know, I can remember we had somebody speak at our performance summit this year who is involved with the All Blacks, which is Don Tricker. And his theory of high performance is quite interesting. He called it the five rights: the right athletes, surrounded by the right people, doing the right things at the right time in the right environment. And I thought it was such a simple philosophy in its own right. And at the end of the day, when you think about it, you only need 15 players and probably then another 15 players. So sometimes we think that greatness inside that 15 is a reflection of volume. It's a reflection of quality. And when you look at the supply chain or the talent chain leading into that, like, there is an incredible, vibrant school system, which is just almost too competitive. And, you know, the standards within that setting, the quality of the coaching, the quality of the strength and conditioning, the quality of the performance science support, the base of that pyramid is really well built. And I think one of the differentiating factors for me is when you speak to anyone within New Zealand rugby, everything is orientated towards the All Black jersey. And there's a really strong common purpose and vision around that. And that's not always the same throughout other rugby nations, where you would have club conflicting with the national team and vice versa. And you don't get harmony inside the system towards, you know, the team really using that small talent pool. And the All Blacks do this brilliantly. They rotate their squads. They give players extended periods of time to rest, rejuvenate. How they integrate family into the consideration around how your preparation actually takes place. So it's definitely, without a doubt, probably the greatest export New Zealand have economically and culturally as well, is it's what's inside the jersey, though, and their ability to bring that all of the time. And that's one of the things about competitive sport. Once you deliver the performance, you've got to do it all over again. So for them to have held that position for as long as they have shows the incredible effort around sustaining it and the amount of active learning and the level and the quality of active leadership within the team as well, from a player perspective.
So Robert, there were really good stories after the loss at the World Cup about how they went hard onto the learning immediately, and how Steve really steered them away from shame. So that's, you know, that's the edge of the culture there, because, you know, we would go hard into shame previously. That's a New Zealand trait, eh? But they learned in 97 that part of that crumbling was the fear of losing. So if they were going to get as good as they've got, they had to also embrace losing as a way of learning to get better.
It's interesting if you compare that to the Irish rugby success of 2018, early 2019, before the World Cup, that we kind of seemed to kind of peak. And it seems to me that the hunters became the hunted. And again, it was something that was passing and wasn't necessarily enduring. It seems to me, Dara, that you've kind of bottled the competitive advantage of New Zealand. We look forward to having you back in Ireland to unleash that competitive advantage here. But probably just one final piece and a big takeaway for me from what all of you have said. And again, it's that old analogy that it's person first, player second, when it comes to sports. And there's definitely a key learning for us around enduring performance in the working world. And I tripped upon a Maori proverb when I was researching this piece, guys, and it was the question of what's the most important thing in the world. And the answer to that question was her tongata, her tongata, her tongata. It's the people, it's the people, it's the people. Guys, thank you both sincerely for joining us, for sharing your insights into high performance sport in New Zealand and beyond. Wish you every success moderately in the sports we compete against, but in your personal lives and professional lives. On behalf of the Talent Summit community, thanks for sharing those insights. I've no doubt they will go a long way to enhance the working lives of all of our people and build that competitive advantage in the short term. Kia ora, guys. Thank you so much for that. So this,
Robert.
Thanks, guys.
Nice work.
So this It is the final episode of Back to Basecamp. I'd like to thank our contributors over the last seven installments. And for all of our viewers, we've had over 4,000 to date from over 25 countries around the world. I want to thank you for tuning in. And my own team at Sigmar, in particular, our producer and director, Julia Purcell, who in many ways is the heart and soul of Talent Summit. I'd like to thank her. I hope this series has challenged your thinking and shared some insights that will enable each of you to rebound faster and more effectively, but most importantly, that it goes some way to enhance the working lives of your people as the world of work continues to change. Until next time, keep well.